And we move to the fifth case this morning, U.S. versus Johnson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis, and I represent Devin Johnson, the defendant appellant. We have raised two issues on appeal. As for the first, the enhancement for the use or possession of a firearm in connection with another felony was erroneously applied in this case. The other felony was an aggravated unlawful use of a weapon offense, AUUW. But the government didn't prove, and the district court never found, the requisite elements for the AUUW offense. It was never established that Mr. Johnson was not an invitee, that he didn't have permission to have the gun on the property.
I thought he was specifically invited to leave once the fight broke out.
I believe it may have been implied that his presence was no longer desired.
I don't think there's any other reasonable inference to be drawn from that fact pattern.
He left, no doubt about it.
Right.
But in any event,
Dad breaks up the two daughters and tells the one to take the boyfriend and leave.
Right, right. He certainly injected himself in a family situation, and as a result is in a bad situation here. But nevertheless, there wasn't a finding by the district court on the invitee issue, Your Honor. And there had to be a specific finding. That's pursuant to this court's Tapia decision. So there was not a finding that he was not an invitee, and there was no evidence proffered at the sentencing hearing. It was the government's responsibility, its burden, to have the enhancement, if it wanted it, to produce the evidence. There's also a problem that he didn't commit a misdemeanor, or at least one was never established by the government, one was never found by the district court. And so far as the government has alleged that there was a battery, of course there was no physical contact, so there would be no battery. And so far as it says that there was an assault, we look to both the objective and the subjective conditions in the case, and that is reflected in the government's own brief where it cites In Re CL. And the objective standard in this case would require what happened while brandishing the weapon. There's also the subjective consideration of the victim. The victim in this case was unaffected, and the district court found that.
Well, I think, again, the reasonable interpretation of what was going on is it was, you know, go ahead and make my day, Clint Eastwood kind of thing, right?
That's one interpretation. I would say the reasonable interpretation is the victim knew that that person with the gun was never going to fire it. And so subjectively, the victim never had a reasonable apprehension of being shot or in any regard experiencing an assault from the individual.
How do you suppose he knew he wasn't going to fire it?
I think that the case law invites consideration of the knowledge of the facts, of the relationship between the individuals. And if you know somebody well enough that you may know not that they're not going to fire, I think that's a fair consideration to make in this case. And I believe that's what happened here. The testimony from Mr. Hunter was that he knew Mr. Johnson from long, long ago. I think they had the type of relationship where he would know that he was never going to pull that trigger regardless of whether he brought the gun, or whether there was a bullet in a chamber, any of those things. There's not a reasonable apprehension. And again, the district court specifically said he was unaffected. We have to give some credence to the district court's conclusion on that. And I believe its instincts were correct on that. There was never a reasonable apprehension of an assault in this case. Never a reasonable apprehension of a battery, rather, such that there could have been an assault. If it all seems incredible to this court, and I hope that it doesn't, there's nevertheless a problem about lack of findings. And that is certainly evident from this record. There were no findings by the district court on the invitee issue, on the permission issue, about what misdemeanor was committed. That lack of finding requires a remand by itself under United States versus Tapia.
Was the issue raised at the time, or is there a forfeiture?
It was raised up and down. Mr. Tassif made a great point about making sure that we find the requisite elements because post People v. Aguilar, there was some considerable difficulty by the state courts determining whether or not this was still a valid statute. And so Mr. Tassif, who was the attorney at the sentencing hearing, explicitly invited the district court to make all of the requisite findings, and that wasn't done. Due to the lack of proof and the absence of findings, the enhancement is improper. Since the government knew it had the burden to prove and didn't prove the requisite facts in the case should be remanded with instructions not to expand the record at sentencing. So they shouldn't be able to bring back in the witness to say, I had a reasonable apprehension, or any of the failures that were made along the way leading up to the wrongful imposition of the enhancement. And so far as the government says that it was harmless error, it is not, because the district court never said that it would impose the same sentence in this case were it not for the four-level enhancement. So I don't think the government can credibly rely on a harmless error analysis in this case. Unless the court has additional questions.
Well, you want it to remand it for resentencing, but limit the district judge to what he can use in resentencing?
The record should be limited to what it was before at the time of the sentencing hearing. They should not now be able to bring in a witness to shore up the defects in the sentencing argument that they made. They relied on the transcript. If the transcript is sufficient to establish the enhancement, so be it. They shouldn't be able to bring in a witness now to say, I had a reasonable apprehension. I was affected.
There may be cases. Do we have cases that say that?
We have drug cases and other cases that consider about whether or not
the amount of the weight of the drugs.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm relying on those, and I realize that it's a different set of circumstances, but nevertheless, there is some precedent for my position. Unless the court has additional questions for me on the enhancement, I'd like to turn with the balance of my time to the conditions of supervised release. Some of my arguments are affected by this court's decision today in the Siegel and the Norfleet cases so far as the mood-altering substances and various considerations of, along those lines. But my bottom line here is simple. There was no imposition of a number of these terms, and the failure to orally pronounce those terms at sentencing under United States versus Alboret makes the inclusion of those sentencing, or excuse me, those supervised release conditions in the judgment null. We don't have to look to those in the judgment because they're unambiguously not imposed at the time of sentencing. The government invites you to consider whether there's a conflict, whether it was consistent, all of these things, and say, well, of course the district court would want those imposed. But the fact is this. The district court unambiguously omitted those at the time of sentencing, and therefore they are not properly included in the judgment. And so if this court was inclined to remand, that would be something the district court could take up with respect to the sentencing. It could then move on to the enhancement as well as the conditions of supervised release. But as things stand, those conditions are null, and they should not be part of the judgment. They should be stricken. The mood-altering substances is something that I've already mentioned. I believe that it's improper because it's vague. I've argued that in my brief, as well as the payment conditions, which I believe there's an absence of authority, and it should not be required of an indigent defendant in particular to have a payment requirement on conditions. And if there is a payment requirement, it should be subject to an ability to pay, and there was not that inclusion of phrase.
Do we have in the record either his income or ability to pay and or the cost of these tests?
We do not, Your Honor, but for this. He was deemed indigent, and that's why my office represented him at the sentencing. But future ability to pay he may have, but this is a present duty, and it should be stricken. And in any event, the statute only allows for the reimbursement of costs, not for the imposition of costs as a forward-going measure.
The judge can always bring the case back in and reimpose all these conditions, unless there's a substantive problem with doing it.
Absolutely. I think, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, that's the better course here. That's the wiser course. We are littering judgments with conditions of supervised release that may or may not be necessary, applicable. Sometime in the future, it may be better to bring in the defendant to modify conditions, and that's exactly what's been suggested in the Norfleet and in the Siegel case that were both issued here today by this court.
Does your argument pertain to mandatory conditions? Do those need to be stated orally on the record, or can they be included summarily in a written judgment?
stating something on the record is always the better course.
Sure, however, better practice, but is there a distinction between mandatory conditions and discretionary conditions?
I'm not making that distinction in this case. That's not an issue, but I will say that the standard conditions are a problem, and if the standard conditions are not mandatory, and they're not in this case, imposing them subsequently in a written judgment while omitting them in the oral pronouncement is a problem. We have that problem here. I reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. My name is Greg Weddle. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. I represent the United States. The four-level enhancement in this case was absolutely appropriate. This court in Purifoy has found that when a defendant pointed his gun at arresting officers, he committed an aggravated assault. That's exactly what Mr. Johnson did here. He pointed a gun at another individual. The only reason that it's a simple assault rather than an aggravated assault is because Mr. Hunter was not a police officer. It's the same statute, and therefore the enhancing statute in this case was not aggravated assault as it was in Purifoy, but it is aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. And that is premised on the predicate offense of assault. And we certainly have assault. In fact, the Illinois Supreme Court in People v. Price held that one who points a loaded revolver at another within shooting distance in a threatening manner is guilty of assault. I think that answers our question in toto here. The district court found that the defendant, Johnson, threatened Mr. Hunter with a gun. He found that Mr. Johnson's intent was to intimidate Mr. Hunter. Remember, they had had an argument. As Judge points out, Mr. Hunter summarily disinvited Mr. Johnson from the premises, said, "Get out of here." But he came back. He came back after changing into dark clothing. He was wearing gloves. There was this surreptitious knock on the door. Mr. Hunter went to the back of his house, opened the door, where he finds Mr. Johnson standing within feet of him, pointing a gun. We know the gun was loaded because his case went to trial, and it was loaded with a high-capacity magazine. The district court made all of the findings. Certainly, there was no issue at sentencing that the enhancement was premised upon, relied upon the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon statute. That's the Tapia offense. That's the offense which the district court was required to notify the defendant that it was relying upon in imposing the enhancement. The elements of that statute then take you down into the aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, which then you have to drill down, and it takes you down to the Illinois assault statute. So there was never any question by the court or any of the parties that ultimately it was this enhancement was premised on whether Mr. Johnson committed or attempted to commit assault on Mr. Hunter when he showed back up to his house and pointed a gun at him.
I suppose there were facts, could be facts, whether you're at the back of the room or we're as close as you and I are, whether or not there was an assault based on that Illinois case.
Well, there could be within shooting distance, and I suppose it depends on how good a shot you are, but I think the district court was proper and said, I assume that any time somebody's pointing a gun at you, you feel threatened. That's a threatening act, and certainly I would feel threatened. I suspect everyone, any reasonable person would feel threatened.
Unless you were so macho you didn't want anybody to know that you were scared, in which case it's either shoot or shut up, kid. get out of here.
Well, right. And perhaps Mr. Hunter exercised some bravado that was uncalled for. Or
that I'll agree I wouldn't do.
But that in no way, that in no way.
What I'm saying is, you don't need. Do we need to send it back to make that determination?
I don't think you do, Your Honor. I think that determination has been made. That he was certainly the evidence in the case was that he was within 20 feet. He was in his backyard. Everybody saw the gun. Everybody saw that Mr. Johnson had a gun and was pointing the gun at Mr. Hunter. Mr. Hunter certainly recognized, and he certainly recognized that he could be shot, as the district court found. He said, either shoot me or get out of here. And I think the district court also said, certainly the evidence at trial was that Mr. Hunter's wife said that she heard Mr. Hunter said, shoot me, I'm not afraid to die. So certainly the district court made all the findings necessary to support the enhancement, and the United States met its burden of proof by relying upon Mr. Hunter's trial testimony and the Illinois statutes that apply in this case. Turning now to the conditions of supervised release, I think we should just ask the question, should it matter that the district court, with respect to the standard and mandatory conditions of supervised release, should it matter that the district court neglected, and we all admit that the district court forgot, to utter the phrase, in addition to the standard conditions of supervised release? That's generally what happens in a sentencing. Those standard conditions of supervised release are contained in the pre-sentence report in all cases, I would submit. Certainly was in this case. Mr. Johnson was aware that those conditions would be applied in his case. In fact, it's boilerplate. It's part of the printed judgment form, which is used in, I would submit, every criminal case in federal court across the land. There was never any doubt.
Of course, they're supposed to be the words that come out of the judge's mouth that are on the...
That's true, Your Honor. That is true. But I think courts have, and I'm asking this court to adopt the rationale of other circuits, which have said that, yes, when it comes to these standard conditions and mandatory conditions, there's a tension, and they're now boilerplate. They're now expected. In fact, the Second Circuit, I think, said that it's even unduly burdensome for the district court to have to pronounce each of these.
Right. They can be imposed summarily. The problem is that they weren't here.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree, and that is true. They can be imposed summarily by saying this phrase in addition to the standard conditions. And my question was, should it really make a difference that the court did not say that when, as in this case, it was contained in the pre-sentence report, it's part of every standard judgment that those conditions will be imposed. In other words, they are inherent in the imposition of a term of supervised release.
I guess the problem is that normally it's just be some sort of administrative thing where we would send it back and the judgment could be altered. So you got to bring the defendant back, right?
Correct.
It's not just sending it back.
Correct. That's true, Your Honor. And as a practical matter, I believe the other circuits have come to this conclusion. I'm asking this court to come to this conclusion that while it's certainly preferable, but when a district court simply forgets, and I would suggest that this district court simply forgot to utter that phrase. I mean, it's a standard phrase that is uttered consistently, just forgot to say it. And should that simple forgetfulness require a resentencing, bring the defendant back simply to say, I'm reimposing supervised release, and in addition to the standard terms, I'm imposing following terms.
How long has this district judge been on the bench?
It's Judge Shadid, and It's been, I'm not entirely sure, 3 or 4 years maybe. Certainly 3 years.
He's chief, isn't he?
He is, Your Honor. Yes.
Well, you get that way by accident of birth. But that's...
I think it's by rotation, and he just happened to get into the rotation, is my understanding. But,
Wait. This is a federal court, isn't it?
Well, the chief judge.
Yeah, but it's not rotation.
The chief position.
Most active judges with this most seniority under
well, that's
65.
True. That's true. Yeah, that's right.
Only if there's nobody else available to do it does it come back again.
Yeah.
Correct. That's what I was referring to. I see my time has expired unless the court has any other questions.
Nope.
I would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed in its entirety.
Thank you, counsel. Any more time? Okay. Yes, another minute.
Thank you. I think the problem when we call these things is boilerplate and inherent is that they're too familiar. They're not familiar to the people who matter most. They should be orally pronounced. And they're not inherent, they're always imposed. In fact, one of the cases the government relied on was Tulloch, which was a Second Circuit case and didn't impose all the conditions. Also, there were not the requisite findings on the four-level enhancement. And if the court looks at the record, it will find that to be the case. And lastly, maybe it wasn't bravado, maybe it was a genuine lack of apprehension. If there's a genuine lack of apprehension, then there's no assault and there's no four-level enhancement, regardless of any of the other factors required by the district court or the government with respect to the AUUW enhancement in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.